So the reason that I have suggested that learning to be content is a fruit that we bear for Jesus is because of the statement that John the Baptist makes to the people that were questioning him. Of course, he makes that statement, you need to bear fruit meet for repentance. And some were asking him, what do we do? What does that mean for us? These were the soldiers who were asking him the question. And his response was, don't extort money, don't accuse people falsely, be content with your pay. So I know that this idea of learning contentment is something that would have fit into that category of fruits meet for repentance. And frankly, as I started studying this and started reading about the idea of contentment, I found out that there might be some things here that I didn't know. Okay? So the first thing that I try to do when I look at a concept or an idea is I try to define it, because it's easy to slip into this mistake that, well, I know what contentment means in 20th century America, 21st century America, but that's not what they heard when they heard this word. When they heard, be content with your pay, what did they hear? And so I looked at, the first thing I looked at was the definitions that some of the lexicographers give. And this is from a Greek word. It's word number 714, according to Strong's numbering system. And it's a word that's used 8 times in the New Testament. Sometimes it's translated content. Sometimes it's translated enough. And that kind of plays into what I thought about being content. So Mounts says that it's an old word that meant to ward off or to be of service or to suffice or to be enough. In the passive, it means to be contented. And that surprised me, because this idea of being of service is not something that I usually associate with being content. And I'm not sure what to make of that. I just pointed out. And it's, you know, something for you to consider as you keep working with this. The NASEC, is the New American Standard Exhaustive Concordance. That's what that stands for. And it says that it's a word of unk or, that means uncertain origin. We don't know exactly. Sorry. We just don't know exactly where this word comes from. He says it's to be enough, to be sufficient, to be content, or satisfied. And he points out that sometimes it's translated content, sometimes enough, sometimes satisfied, sometimes sufficient. So Strong, one of the lexicographers that we're very familiar with, he says it's a primary verb, but it's probably akin to the idea of raising a barrier again, that's one of those things that I'm not sure I understand what contentment has to do with raising a barrier and how that's related. But he says it's to ward off or by application, or by implication, excuse me, to avail or literally or figuratively to be satisfactory. That makes sense to me, that it's to be satisfied with, to be content, it's enough or it's sufficient. And then Thayer says that it's to be possessed of unfailing strength. And once again, that's not something that I'm typically going to think of when I think of being content, 21st century terms. He says it's to be strong, to suffice, to be enough, to defend or to ward off something. There's that idea again of raising a barrier, warding off.
That's what I was thinking. Maybe a barrier, they could be talking about some trouble or problems that you're having in your life, and that you're able to raise above that or get strength enough to
get through that. That may be the relationship there.
And to be strong. I think, like Paul, he had to be strong in his circumstances because, you know, being in prison.
Yeah.
You know, so he had to be, I don't mean like this strong, but I mean strong in, I'm going to be content with the position I'm in.
Right.
And stick with it.
Mentally strong.
Right.
Mentally aware.
And maybe I'm off. Maybe they can't.
No, that makes sense. Because then I was reading in the Pulpit Commentary, which is just a group of people who got together and they write down their thoughts about what this all means. And they had some interesting things to say. You'll see that on the next page where he talks about godliness and contentment. But they suggested this is in their commentary on 1 Timothy 6, where Paul says to be content in verse 6. He says, godliness with contentment is great gain. So I was thinking about this in terms of 1 Timothy. When Timothy reads this, what does Timothy understand when Paul says, godliness with contentment is great gain? Because I started to think, you know, what would first century Christians have thought about being content with what you have?
With their lifestyle and their ability to better themselves, I guess, but then they have God to fall back on ask for help.
Right. But they really didn't have the ability to better themselves. Because a lot of them faced forfeiture of their possessions, their land, their houses. Like the apostle said to Jesus, we've given up lands or houses and even families in order to follow you. So how do you be content with what you have, knowing that at any time it could be taken away from you?
Well, I think only your faith in God could get you through that.
Okay. Any thoughts from anybody at home?
But they were more used to living. Well, most of them, not all of them, but most of them were more used to living that way, you know, without. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, we flip on a switch or turn on the tap, and boy, if our water, they shut off the water or the lights go out, oh, why? You know, we're so, I mean, we don't go into a frenzy, hopefully, but it's so foreign to us, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think about the people that have no water, they have no electricity. They, I mean, it's sad in places in the world.
Yeah. Think about what it was like just last winter when we had the ice storm and people didn't have heat in their house and we were worried about, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
We're going to freeze to death, you know.
And all the people that lost everything in the hurricanes. That can't even imagine.
I can't. And the sand that's in their house.
Yeah, and it's even worse when it's the government that just comes in and confiscates everything.
Yeah.
And you have no say, you know.
Yeah.
So I thought about those people and Paul saying, be content.
It's easy to say,
yeah.
Not easy to do.
Yeah. And then I thought about Paul.
Yeah. He what?
Because in a sense, Paul had lost most of what he had. He was, before he became a Christian, Paul is advanced in the Jewish religion beyond anybody his age. He is a rabbi. He's well respected. And the rabbis live pretty well. So he becomes a Christian. He walks away from all of that. Now, in his case, it was voluntary. And so I say, well, okay, we have to be willing to lose everything. If we're going to be content, be willing to lose everything. But then there are people in Christianity who had a great deal of money. Some of them had lands and houses, and they sold it so that they could care for the people that were around them. So what that tells me is that they were at least wealthy enough that they had land or houses, and that didn't call into question them being content. It's like, you know, somebody says, well, yeah, sure, I could be content if I get everything I want, and then I stop wanting a lot more.
Right. I don't think that's what they're talking about.
I don't think that is either, but it's really interesting to me. Especially this statement that he makes in 1 Timothy. Look at verse 5. Let me see. I don't think I want verse 5. I want the end of verse 5. He's saying these are things, some things that they have that are unhealthy for them. And he says they have an unhealthy interest in controversies and quarrels about words that result in envy, strife, malicious talk, evil suspicions, constant friction between people of corrupt mind who have robbed the truth, who have been robbed of the truth, and who think that godliness is a means to financial gain. So, how were there people who were thinking that godliness would be a means of financial gain?
Well, I don't know, but I do know a couple that believed that. They said, the more we give, the more we get. And I said, I don't think that's what you give.
Okay.
But I mean, and they thought the more they gave financially, the more they got financially. It wasn't the more we give, the more we're bearing fruit and getting blessings and blessing other people. They weren't thinking of that. They were thinking of their financial gain.
Yeah, they were thinking of it as an investment.
Right.
If I give, I get back more.
Right.
So I'm willing to give. That's just temporary. I'm going to get it all.
Yeah, see, but
that doesn't seem very Christian to me.
Okay, that could be it. Could be that there were some people who thought that if I become a Christian, I can use that for financial gain. And I can talk about that in 21st century terms. I don't know how they would have thought about it. But in what I can read, by the 3rd or 4th century, when the situation changed and the Roman Empire became more understanding of Christians, and in fact, more supportive of Christians, after the Edict of Constantine, there were people who would become Christians because that meant that they had an elevated place in society. So they would use Christianity to elevate themselves. And, you know, I have known people, at one time I sold life insurance, and the manager of the office that I worked for said to me, "You're a member of the church, there's a built-in base, go sell them." And he was treating my association with Christians as a means of financial gain. I remember when Amway was real big, and that's one of the pitches that they made. Pitch people that you're at church with. I sold real estate for a while, and the realtor that I worked for said, "You need to quit going to that little church over there, and you need to go to a big church because you'll have more clients." So I can see how people today might say that godliness, or what I call godliness, is a way to get financial gain. I have a harder time figuring it out for those people back there.
Right.
Other than for Paul, you know, because for him, godliness, before he became a Christian, godliness meant serving Jehovah to the best of his ability, and that made him advance in the Jewish religion. Okay? So in that sense, maybe that's true. And remember, Timothy is with a primarily Jewish group. So that thought pattern might have been there. Now I'll tell you something else that's really interesting. When you look at 1 Timothy chapter 6 at verse 5, there are some people that think that godliness is a means to gain. Some of the newer translations say that gain is a means to godliness. And to be honest, I can't tell you which one of those translations is the best. Is it that there are people who think that godliness is a means to financial gain, and some people that think that financial gain is a means to godliness? King James. Does anybody have the King James?
I have New King James.
Okay, what's the New King James say? 1 Timothy 6 at verse 5.
Useless wranglings of men of corrupt minds and destitute of the truth, who suppose that godliness is a means of gain.
Okay.
From such withdraw yourself.
Okay, so that's in keeping with the New International. What translation do you have, Don?
I have the New American Standard.
And what does it say?
It says, "In constant friction between men of depraved mind and deprived of the truth, who suppose that godliness is a means of gain."
Okay, so those translations tend to that kind of an understanding. But there are other translations that say that gain is a means of godliness.
If you go down to verse 6, it says, "But godliness actually is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment."
Okay.
Yeah, now the mind says, "Now godliness with contentment is a great gain."
So it's similar, it just the words are just, yeah, different.
Yeah.
I'm not different, but
yeah, I can't tell you which way to understand it.
I don't know, but when it says, "From such withdraw yourself," I'm supposing that either way, it's not good.
Either yeah. Way. Don't have anything to do with these people.
Right. Yeah.
And to be honest, our financial status and what we have, the stuff that we have, can be overwhelming for us. It can be the primary driver of everything that we do in our life. Every decision we make, the first thing we think about is, how is this going to affect my retirement? Or how is it going to affect my investments? And that's not contentment. So we need to work on building contentment. Verse 7, he said, here in 1 Timothy 6, he says, "We brought nothing into the world, we're going to take nothing out. But if we have food and clothing, we'll be content with that." Now, that can make it sound like you have to be poor if you're content. That the attitude that Christians must have is, "I need food and clothes, and that's all I need."
Well, kind of like your friend you were talking about that had two pairs of pants and two shirts. And
yeah, and the reason he had two was so he could wash one while he wore the other.
Yeah.
Yeah, had one pair of shoes and two pair of socks and two pairs of pants and two shirts. Had one coat.
Well, maybe there's something to be said for that. Because I've got 20 pairs of jeans.
My closet's so full, I have to pry things apart.
I know, it's terrible.
Well, I have more than two pairs of pants, but that's because some I can wear when I lose weight, and some
exactly.
I can wear when I gain weight.
Exactly, you know? I have both sets. Yes, and
I got my fat pants and my skinny pants.
Yeah, that's right.
Unfortunately, Mike's skinny ones don't get used very much.
No, Mike don't either. But someday, I'm not giving them away, because someday.
Someday I will wear those again.
I'll be skinny again. Oh. That's how, well, that's not being very content.
I'm content to let them hang in my closet.
Well, the truth is, we're very blessed.
We are.
We are. And having to live like they did, And I mean, they were not only living without, they were under constant, whatever the word is, fear, because they were, I hate to say because they were Christians, but
because they were trying to live godly lives, and there's people there that wanted to kill them because of that. And I guess that still goes on in the foreign countries today.
Yeah, it does. It does. I read a story in one of my news feeds today. A man who is a realtor on his personal Facebook page posted biblical verses dealing with men and women, and just posted the passages, and they're threatening him with taking away his real estate license. So
he won't
be able to make a living. It happens, and that's happening here. That's in our country. That's not some third world backwater country. That's happening here. So, you know, we could lose everything that we have. And I guess that's a part of it. I had a really good friend who, he kind of, in my mind, he embodied what Paul said in Philippians 4. That's the last passage that I have listed here. Philippians 4, he says, verse 10, I rejoice greatly in the Lord that at last you renewed your concern for me. Indeed, you were concerned, but you had no opportunity to show it. I'm not saying this because I'm in need, for I've learned to be content, whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know how to have plenty. I've learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether in plenty or in want. I can do all this through him who gives me strength. So, being content doesn't mean being poor. It doesn't mean an unwillingness to have plenty. And if you have plenty, that doesn't mean that you're not content. But we sometimes think that. And we shouldn't think that.
Well, then we think we are sometimes, and then something comes up, like extra, not an extra bill, but an extra thing for the house that you have to have. Not, you know, what I mean is not, you know, something breaks down, you have to fix it. Yeah, or the car breaks down, and you have to have the car. And then you think, oh, you know, can't I be content with the car? No. So, you know, got to get it fixed, and it's an extra expense.
Yeah. Got this expense to take care of my second car.
Yeah, I know. Exactly. That's, yeah. True. That's true.
Yeah.
We just thank God all the time we can pay our bills.
Yeah.
It gets tight sometimes, but.
Yeah. But it's not easy to learn to be content.
I know when we think we are, but like I said, when something comes up like that, you know, you have to really talk to yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think his statement in Hebrews 13 is a good one. He says, keep your lives free from the love of money. Don't let money be the controlling interest in your life.
Right. Well, and people don't realize it's the love of money, not the money. It's the love of it, that it's more important than God or anything. It's that. It's not that you know, people say, well, if you have money, then you're not, you know, you're not godly and all that. It doesn't say that. It says the love of money, that you put, you know, that's putting your money before God.
Yeah. And the love of money bears fruit by itself. We pierce ourselves through with many evils. And
that's the wrong kind of fruit.
Yeah, that's that's just an understanding that whatever you do, it's going to bear fruit. And it will bear fruit. That's why Paul said, those that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare. If your goal in life is to be wealthy, then you are bound to have problems. He that loves money labors to put it into a bag with holes in it. So I think the Proverbs writer was correct in that one. I had a really good friend who was a Christian that we knew when we lived in. We had some weird friends in the past.
Oh.
Okay. He became a Christian, and he had all kinds of stuff. He was living high on the hog, you know. And then all of a sudden it was gone. He had an investment that fell through, and he moved from Alaska in a car. Not a truck, not a van. He moved his family of him, his wife, and two daughters in a car down to Arizona. Yeah, and now he lives in a 7,000 square foot house, you know. But I have always known him to say, I've got to serve God. If I make money, that's fine. If I don't, that's fine too.
That's a good attitude.
That takes a lot to have that attitude.
Yeah.
And developing that, I think, really gets back to whether we believe God is going to be there for us or not.
If you go just down to the verse 9 in the First Timothy, it says, but those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires, which plunge men into ruin and destruction.
Yeah.
So it's all how you use it and react to what you get.
Yeah. And sometimes if you live frugally, if you spend your time realizing all of this, that you're just taking care of what God has given you, if you take good care of it, you may wind up with a good bit of it. I think somehow the parable of the sowers, the parable of the talents, excuse me, is instructive here. Remember, the husbandman or the owner goes away, and to the man who had 10 talents, he gave 10. To the one who had 3, he gave 3. And so if you prove to be a good steward, I think you will be blessed by God. And remember that finally it's going to get down to, if God gives you this, he expects you to use it. And he may give you more, and that's a test in itself. He may take away what you have, and that's a test. And so it's kind of like Job. You know, we have a tendency to be like Job's 3 friends who came to him and after Job had lost everything. Remember? And they said, Job, fess up. What did you do wrong?
Yeah.
Blame on him.
And then he wound up at the end with more than he had when he started.
Yeah.
Okay, so what are his friends going to say then? You know.
He might say, say, what did you do again?
Yeah, what did you do? And it's like John 9, remember the, you know, the man that was born blind? And the apostles came to Jesus and said, okay, who sinned?
Yeah.
Him or his parents that he was born blind? That betrays a lack of contentment and a lack of understanding of contentment.
But I mean, I don't know where my dad was taught that, but he kind of believed that if something went wrong, a child was born not quite right, that it was somebody's fault. It had to be, because we're looking for answers, I think, and it had to be somebody's fault.
Yeah.
But we live in a world that things happen. It's not always a fault.
Yeah.
I mean, it can be in some cases, like, you know, a drug person or whatever. But
it's not.
No.
It's not always.
No. Oh, no.
And we...
9 times out of 10, it's not.
Yeah, and we bring a lot of grief on ourselves because we forget that that's the case, and we blame ourselves for whatever evil there is, and that's
I think that's normal though. I mean, you know, I blame myself for a lot of things, so. And maybe rightly so.
Yeah. But we don't want to do that. So I think learning contentment is a real fruit of the Spirit. The only way you're going to have that is if you understand God is there, and I have to leave it in the hands of God. I may have a lot, I may not have a lot, but God is always constant. Any thoughts from folks at home? I don't mean to ignore you, and I hate turning my back on you. That's just the way this room's set up. But any thoughts?
Well, I read that, but I still got to mention it. Because I knew if I didn't ask some of the questions, I'd be forgetting.
Okay.